This week, silver added a dollar, up 5%, while the NASDAQ closed at a new bull market zenith. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure to be back with you this weekend. We have another big show lined up with two top industry insiders, including Nick Barishev of Bullion Management Group. He says most of the above-ground silver stockpiles were sold before the year 2000. Only 20% of current silver is the byproduct of pure silver mines. The remaining 80% is derived from base metal production, such as lead. The net result, 50% of silver demand is industrial, so no matter how costly silver becomes, industrial demand for items like solar panels, laptops, iPhones, Androids, well, it's likely to remain close to constant. Even if jewelry demand were to drop to zero, the remaining 50% industrial demand could hold up prices. Then the head of Trends Research Institute, Gerald Celente, returns to the show. He says when gold closes firmly above $1,400 an ounce, which from a technical vantage point, the market appears to be gearing up for a run to $1,400, he says a new bull market will be underway. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear editorial. And if you haven't already signed up for my Alpha Stocks newsletter, portfolios continue to outperform the general market. You can send an email request to me at gsr@hughes.net or just sign up at the radio.goldseek.com webpage. Goldseek Radio begins now with a market weather recap. Sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector on U.S. dollar weakness following dovish comments from the FOMC meeting as well as the BOJ. By Friday's close, the yellow metal was up $32, finishing at $13.41, adding 2.5% for the week. Silver, though, stole the show, up nearly a dollar, 5%. The precious metals XAU shares finished up 4 points, almost 5%, finishing at $95.76 above solid support, while West Texas Intermediate crude did pick up just less than a dollar, closing at $44.50 a barrel, adding 2%. The top stories leading to the best weekly advance in about 2 months included dovish comments from the FOMC meeting. Policymakers announced plans to hold rates steady at least until after the elections. Gold rallied following the Federal Reserve's decision on Wednesday. The Fed reassured investors that rates would likely hold steady at least until December. Lower yields improves gold's appeal relative to interest-bearing securities. In related news on Friday, data showed that U.S. manufacturing activity in September grew at the most lackluster pace in 3 months. Slower growth signals lower odds of rate hikes and increased odds of perhaps even negative rates in the years to come. In addition, bullion is usually purchased for festivals and wedding seasons in India, as well as Christmas, Hanukkah, and related seasonal factors. While the World Gold Council noted record demand for the first half of 2016, 16% higher than the last peak in 2009. The first time we've seen that type of growth in financial history. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, the U.S. dollar remains under resistance, still building what appears to be a complex head and shoulders pattern. Gold and the XAU are above support, and silver played catch-up this week, blasting above resistance, which is now support, outperforming all the sectors. So the nascent bull market appears to remain intact. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, mostly sunny skies on the New York Stock Exchange following news that the BOJ plans to increase liquidity and dovish comments from the Fed. The news sent the tech sector into high gear. Shares in Twitter and Google helped buoy the markets. The Dow Jones Industrials added 138 points for the week, finishing at 18,261. The S&P 500 picked up 26 points, over 1%, at 2164, while the NASDAQ was the superstar, adding 61 points, over 1%, finishing at 5305, a new bull market record. Again, the Federal Reserve held off on raising rates, which encouraged purchases in technology stocks. Shares in Twitter surged 21% on reports, and one of our favorite alpha stock candidates, Google shares, blasted higher this week after being on our list for many, many weeks and appears to be poised to make at least another 100-point run. Bottom line on Wall Street. Although the NASDAQ record close was impressive, the S&P 500 is still relatively weak, suggesting that a correction still could unfold in the next few weeks. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio. We'd like for you to stay with us at GoldSeek. Gerald Celente of the Trends Research Institute joins us today. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Well, you know, the headlines read 29 injured. I'm sure you saw this explosion in New York, another explosion in a New Jersey train. And then this morning we read of bombs seized.
Well, let's look at the New Jersey, New York. The fellow they have in custody, you know, is Afghan. America launched a war against Afghanistan, and we outlined this in the Trends Journal. We took George Bush's speeches of the evening of 9/11 and the one when he addressed the nation 9 days later. Not one fact in it. We said something like only a madman would speak these words and only people dumbstruck with fear would believe them. Not one fact as to why we invaded Afghanistan. And then we saw the 28 pages that were mostly redacted of the 9/11 Commission. What is it, 15 out of the 19 alleged people that struck the World Trade Center and the Pentagon were Saudis? So that makes perfect sense then. Okay, let's invade Afghanistan, launch by far the longest war in American history, based on no facts at all. And again, we outlined everything that was going on at that time, where the Taliban was saying that they would do everything they can not to have war. George Bush, quote, we don't have time to talk. So now this guy's Afghan. Now, if you lived in Afghanistan, your entire country was destroyed because there was somebody allegedly there hiding, and now you're being occupied by foreign nations. You think you'd become a terrorist? Everybody you love is dead or whatever. Or you're seeing what's going on in your country while you're not living there. So what I'm saying is whether these terror strikes are false flag or real, no one's talking about who caused the atmosphere for terror. How about invading Iraq based on lies? Oh, we just heard Colin Powell, when he lied to the American people on TV, holding his little vial as proof that that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and ties to al-Qaeda. Now we're hearing from his emails that they hacked, but where was his courage? How come he's not being brought up on war crimes for lying us into war? Whether these terror strikes are false flags or real, they've been using them to get the Americans' minds off the terrible economy, as they did back in 9/11. People forget we were in a recession. What got us out of it was Alan Green's scam, lowered interest rates to 46-year lows, and created the real estate bubble and the financial bubble. And they can't, and the other thing, too, is look at the study that came out last week out of the UK that showed what a fraud the Libyan war was and how they were lied into it. And look at the chaos that's created. So when you look at what's going on around the world and you look at America's track record at starting wars based on lies, I'm old enough of Vietnam War era, and there was no Gulf of Tonkin incident the way they said it happened. It was an outright lie. And just as Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and ties to al-Qaeda, and it made perfect sense to invade Afghanistan because Osama bin Laden, a Saudi, was hanging out there. So if you're going to keep bombing these countries into oblivion, killing millions of people, you're going to have terror strikes, whether they're false flag or real.
Fascinating story just hit the headlines a few days ago. The change in technology and the impact it's had on society. Now, you on Trends Journal really do a great job bringing the latest technological developments and the trends and themes and biases that we see there and the importance to keep our hand on it. But some people are concerned, Gerald, that maybe technology might be getting a bit ahead of us.
We're going out of the industrial age. And so it's from industrialization into robotization. And that's basically what we're looking at. and we're going to be losing more and more of those jobs. Just like with industrialization, you know, it took people out of their homes that were making things and put them into a centralized location. The initial impacts are going to hit society hard, but something new will develop after that. So, for example, start looking for a whole new education system. You know, you're seeing interactive, artificial intelligence and virtual reality. So now you're going to have virtual reality classrooms, because what happens is you're looking at new generations that are being born into this, infants. You know, you see them, the little kids. Everybody's addicted to these things. As soon as they reach an age, they have their world in their hands.
No, you've got it. You know, our 3-year-old Gerald is already interacting verbally with an Alexa Echo from Amazon and controlling the internet for music.
So now it becomes a whole new world for them. So now you're going to start seeing new developments. Again, talking about education. This is an industrial age model to put people in centralized locations. You know, they took them off the farms and whatever else they were doing, and to teach them how to read, write, do a little bit of arithmetic, and follow orders. Now we're out of the industrial age, but we're still using an industrial age outmoded system. And when I say the education system's outmoded, look at America's education system. It's one of the most expensive in the world, and we don't even win, place, or show compared to many other nations. We're antiquated, and if our education system was working, do you think the nation would be the problems that we have today? So what I'm saying is, yes, you're right, but there's another side to this. The other part of it is that we see as a real danger of such is that robotization will take over humanization, in the sense that, you know, people ask Siri how it should be done. So there, think for yourself is an old line that we used to use, but people aren't doing it anymore. They're letting the internet and the digital world think for them. So there's going to be pluses and minuses, and there's going to be a lot of breakthroughs, too, in a very positive way. So when you look at artificial intelligence, you know, we're looking at it as when, whether it's medicine or biogenetics, whatever it might be, that are going to work toward helping, you know, people with Alzheimer's, and they don't work, start looking for artificial intelligence to make it work. So we're doing a lot, and same thing with vision. You know, if it doesn't happen with, you know, the medical end, start looking for the artificial end. We have an aging population worldwide, so you're going to start seeing more and more technologies advance in a positive way to help society as they age and move into different directions.
We don't want to vilify technology. This Alexa Echo, I mean, imagine how that can help folks with, as you mentioned, Alzheimer's, or folks with Asperger's syndrome, or someone else on that spectrum, and other folks who just don't have that interaction that is affordable, becoming very affordable, I think, for the typical household. And that's just one tiny little aspect of artificial intelligence, really an expert system, but artificial intelligence. So I think you make a great point, meaning that we've got to embrace it, but we've got to be careful with it. And we have to think this through carefully. But don't you agree, though, that another culprit here plaguing the U.S., 1 in 5 Americans have less than $100 in savings?
Well, again, look at the jobs that are being created. You know, you look at the data. I mean, you know, we went from manufacturing jobs to health services and retail and hospitality sector that don't pay living wages. I mean, what are we're subsidizing the people that work in Walmarts and these other places because they don't earn enough. So, and then you look at the costs of living, these CPI numbers are a lot of baloney. And so they're not real numbers. Inflation's much higher than they report. And then you look at, okay, people are going into debt. They're certainly not buying homes because home ownership now is back to 1960s levels. And the millennials are living at home. There's about a third of them in that age bracket. And that age group owns less homes at that age bracket than in modern times. So the debt levels are real. And then you talked about savings. Or where are you going to put your money? You're not going to put it in the bank because you're not going to get anything back on it. So that's why you also have no savings. There's no place to put it. You have to gamble in the markets. And when you look at the people that are in the market, it's only about 10% of Americans that really, you know, profit from the equity markets. So it's a double-sided sword. One in that income levels stink, and you're looking at median household income below 1999 levels. And the other part is, where do you put your savings? You don't put it in the bank and get it any interest rates on them with near zero interest rate policy and negative interest rate policy in other nations.
Perfect segue into another discussion, and that is, where do you put your savings? And, of course, the place where folks were glad they put their savings, at least this year in 2016, the precious metals. I mean, we've seen gold and silver move sharply higher while stocks lagged for a while. Now we're backing and filling, and there's some volatility entering the markets. Do you like the precious metals on a forward basis? It certainly looks like we may have the worst behind us and perhaps a new bull market develop.
We're forecasting, and you know I've said this on your show, I don't know how many times, gold has to go over $1,400 an ounce. And then we believe it's going to be the beginning of the gold bull run. We had said that gold would bottom out at around $1,150. We nailed it. And now, to us, as you mentioned, what, gold is up about 26% on the year. So if you invested in gold this year, or silver, which is up even more, you made good investments. Going back to negative interest rates, zero interest rate policy, and stimulus and helicopter money, to me, why would I want to own digital money backed by nothing and producing, you know, nothing? So that's why I'm bullish on gold and precious metals. And then put on top of that the geopolitical unrest.
Yes, indeed. There's always that excellent insurance policy that we all need in our portfolios. Well, as we wrap up today, I bet I've missed a couple of topics or news events.
Well, again, talking about the geopolitical events and tying it all together, all things are connected. Look at oil prices. They're down around $46, $47 a barrel. Saudi Arabia, for example, needs $100 a barrel to break even. I'm mentioning Saudi Arabia because they're waging a war against the innocent people in Yemen, killed, you know, well over 15,000 of them already, destroyed the poorest nation in the Middle East, because when all else fails, as I say, they take you to war. It's failing in the Middle East. The war drums keep beating louder. And we were very concerned about an explosion over there, whether it comes from Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, whether it's happening in Libya, another blowout in Iraq. So what I'm saying is the geopolitical aspects turned on to and on top of the populist movements going on throughout Europe where they're destabilizing the governments, plus economic downturns. You're looking at GDP growth in America, what, at 1%? Less than that in Europe. Only, what, 1.2% in Hong Kong. It's a global slowdown. We're looking at conditions very volatile now. And again, that's why we're bullish on gold as a safe haven asset.
Please tell people more about the Trends Journal.
Well, we have the Trends Journal, which, of course, is a quarterly, 54 pages, full color, either magazine or digital, a very high-quality magazine. Of course, we Trends monthly, Trend Alerts each week, and Trends in the News broadcasts every Monday through Friday, only $99 a year. And we know that people are having a difficult time, so we have a discount request page because we want to provide history before it happens for everyone so they can seize the opportunities and avoid the dangers.
Gerald Celente, thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
President and CEO of Bullion Management Group, BMG, widely recognized as an international bullion expert, Mr. Nick Barashev returns to Gold Seek Radio. Welcome back to the show, Nick Barashev.
Oh, happy to be on your show again, Chris.
Well, it's a delight to have you back today, and I wonder how the weather is way north in Toronto, Canada.
Well, it's great. We're experiencing a bit of an Indian summer, so let's hope it lasts long. A lot of people are predicting a heavy-duty winter, so we'll take it while we can.
We were talking about today, before the show started, the silver market, AG, that tiny relative to gold market that has fascinated investors and explorers for hundreds of years. Over 400 years ago, there was an enormous find south of the border, led to all kinds of strange economic anomalies. But now, once again, it's a rare commodity.
50% of the silver demand is industrial demand. And, you know, as a result, what happens there is silver has a unique characteristic in that it's supply and demand inelastic. Typically, like if the price of a commodity goes up, the demand goes down, which is what happens in the jewelry uses of gold and silver. If the price goes up, jewelry demand drops. In the case of industrial demand, because there are no substitutes for silver, it doesn't matter what the price is for silver, the demand will not drop. And that's simply because, you know, there's a few cents worth of silver in your iPhone. So it doesn't matter whether the price of silver, $20 or $200, same number of iPhones will get sold. It doesn't affect the end product. So that's how it is on the demand side. On the supply side, 83% of silver supply is byproduct of things like copper, zinc, lead, etc. So if you get a price spike in silver, say silver goes to 200, there's going to be no effect on supply. You're not going to produce more copper or lead or zinc just to get a few more ounces of silver out. You have no effect there. So the industrial demand actually works the opposite of what people think. It doesn't suppress the price. Once you have the monetary demand move the price of silver, then the industrial demand won't slow it. They'll just have to go with it. Example of that, I think it was 1998, there was a rising demand in palladium, and you need palladium largely for gas-powered catalytic converters. And Ford bought something like $2 billion of palladium at twice the prevailing spot price. That's what happens to the industrial demand. So without silver, you don't produce iPhones, you don't produce solar panels, a whole bunch of industrial commodities. There's no replacement. So these people that think that industrial demand suppresses the price, dead wrong.
And that's where there's a big difference. If you take gold and platinum, most mine production comes from pure gold mining companies. They're not byproducts, where only 20% of the silver is from pure silver mines. There's a number of factors, and one of the things is that, as you mentioned, it's a tiny market. There's under $2 billion of silver produced every year, and there's very little in above-ground stocks these days, like there was in the 80s and so on. There was U.S. Mint had about 1 billion ounces, and then there was 1 billion ounces in strategic reserves. All that's been sold and gone. There isn't a great deal of above-ground supply and relatively little annual supply from a mine point of view. And when you take a look at those numbers and compare it to, you know, global financial assets of about $250 trillion, you can appreciate, you know, even a fraction of that $250 trillion decides it's now time to hold hard assets like gold and silver, you'll have a dramatic move in both, but particularly in silver, because it's so much of a smaller market. Like the annual gold market's about $90 billion compared to silver's $2 billion. The other thing is we've gone to a more leveraged situation on the COMEX. So we've got, in terms of the, you know, current futures contracts, they stand at about 120% of annual mine supply. And there's about 44 owners per every ounce of eligible inventory at the COMEX. So at some point in time, that story is going to end badly, and there's going to be a huge short covering have to happen. The easiest thing to look at is the gold-silver ratio. So right now, it undervalues silver because we're at about a ratio of 68 and $19 silver. Now, the average has been 47. Now, if we move to an average of 47 at today's gold price, you get $27 silver. And we've reached lows of around 17, and that would give us $76 silver at today's gold price. So you can see there's a lot of room there. Like, for instance, a lot of people think we will be, you know, at the $2,000 mark for gold in the near future. And if we go to the average 47 ratio for silver, you'd get a $42 silver price, which is about a double from today's pricing. So that's what you've got, is a double contribution. You've got kind of a rising price for a lot of macroeconomic issues and, you know, levels of debt and, you know, all those conditions that people talk about. But the silver would go up proportionately more because it would rebalance back to a normalized ratio.
Very good. $10,000 gold. This is a target that maybe seemed lofty a decade ago or even two or three decades ago, but it's now becoming a price target that we hear more regularly.
That's right. There's lots of people that predicted the $10,000 number and even higher numbers, Jim Rickards being one of them. The way I came up with the $10,000 gold number is simply up until the correction in 2011, the price of gold and the U.S. debt has been almost perfectly correlated. And at 2011, we had a correction. I think that was an artificial correction with a lot of, you know, manipulation of paper markets. But nevertheless, there was a correction. So right now, if we were to get back to that ratio, we should be over $2,000 gold right now. Now, the reality of the situation is that U.S. debt is not going down. Doesn't matter who gets elected president. Doesn't matter what happens, the U.S. debt is not going to even slow down, let alone decline. As the U.S. debt goes up, you're simply going to have the price of gold follow it up. And that's where in the very near future, you get to that relationship of U.S. debt to gold.
Last check, we were approaching $20 trillion now on official U.S. debt. But we've also had some great guests on the show, including Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, who is an outspoken advocate of balancing the budget and reducing debt. And he's very concerned by entitlement program spending, which he claims is at $199 trillion when we account for all that we will eventually have to pay out under the current system. According to your methodology, we would then see gold have to reflect much higher prices.
Well, exactly, and this is the problem. Like because of so much of the the annual deficit is the entitlements. Politically, I can't see that ever changing. You know, who's going to say we're going to cut Social Security and Medicare to balance budgets? It's just not happen.
Other issues facing the markets, of course, includes global demand from the two economic behemoths and emerging economic powerhouses, India and China. Cultures very different, but a huge propensity for an interest in the precious metals and silver, of course. But as gold becomes more scarce and more pricey, suddenly silver becomes a much more appealing alternative to the yellow metal. And demand, of course, remains robust in India and China. And now we hear that the financial institutions are perhaps stockpiling and even hoarding gold in anticipation of difficult economic times ahead, and perhaps even currency wars, and maybe even a new global reserve currency.
One of the things that isn't on the radar, it certainly isn't in the mainstream media, Chinese yuan is accepted into the SDR back last year, and it's activated September 30th of this year. Now, China officially has 1,600 tons of gold. Many analysts have looked at, you know, the imports and supply demand and everything else, and the estimates are that China has in excess of 5,000 tons of gold. What the implications there are, and what China does, is they buy the gold in their sovereign wealth fund. It doesn't report to anybody. And when it suits them, they transfer the gold to the central bank, where it's then officially reported. So up until the time that China becomes an active part of the SDR, being currently allocated 10% of the SDR allocation, then China has no real motivation to announce their true gold holdings. Once they're actively part of the SDR and they need to get more than 10%, the way the SDR formula works is they then would announce their true gold holdings. And if their true gold holdings are 5,000 tons or more, then their allocation would more double. That's the objective of China, so that the SDR ultimately replaces the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. That's in play now. The bigger move is if China announces that they have, say, 5,000 tons of gold, the question becomes, where did that gold come from? Because the reporting agencies, GFMS and CPM, have already accounted for all the gold, okay, right down to a fraction of an ounce in terms of scrap supply. So where did this 5,000 tons of gold come from? So the only place it can come from is leased gold from the central banks, the Western central banks. So if China ever announces that they have 5,000 tons of gold, that means the Western central banks don't have 5,000 tons of gold.
You know, the United States had at the top of the gold stockpile list, reserve list, at over 9,000 tons, and the estimates were 3,000 to 4,000 tons with China. But one of our guests here, Dr. Stephen Lieb, agrees with you. There could be close to 25,000 tons in China. Now, not all of the People's Bank of China, but split among their massive money center banks and financial institutions, as well as in sundry locations. Of course, it's speculation, but it's something to think about. If we merge your two ideologies together, it really has some fascinating implications.
Well, like I say, I think the implications are it was handled in the book called The Big Reset, where I think this is where things are going eventually, because at some point there's no possibility the debt will ever be repaid, either U.S. debt or global Western debt. So the only thing you can do is reset it. Jim Rickards talks about it, and there's been examples of resets in the past throughout history, so there's nothing new. It'll be, you know, largely reset against gold and silver, and it won't be like we had the early part of this bull market from 2002 to 2011, where it was sort of a stair-step increase. You know, one morning on a Monday morning, you'll wake up and the gold price will be $2,000 or $3,000 higher. And if you don't have it, it'll be too late to buy it.
And it's so well said, because despite our wonderful transportation system we have today, nothing like the 70s and 80s. All around the world, you know, packages shipped by UPS, FedEx, and DHL, and so many others, just to the most remote locations. You have eBay. We also have lost the mom and pop coin shop that we all grew up with, where we traded in our pennies. They were just the best.
Well, it's interesting that the kids, if you've ever given a, you know, gold or silver coin to the kids as a birthday present or, you know, anything like that, they get it right away. You don't have to explain to them that this is real money and this has value. They instantly get it.
Because they haven't been corrupted by the media sources that view it as a barbarous relic.
Exactly.
It's anathema to the system.
The issue in terms of our company, we're launching our third mutual fund, which is a silver fund. The first fund that I launched back in 2002 is a gold, silver, platinum. Then we launched a gold-only fund in 2008, and now we're launching a silver fund to round that out. And the issue is all our funds are open-end mutual fund trusts, which is critical compared to the other methods like closed-end funds, because we purchase and redeem bullion into the bullion market, so our liquidity is the same as the bullion markets themselves. We also don't compromise any aspects of that. We don't market time, we don't hedge, we don't lease, we don't do that. You decide when to buy and when to sell, and we accommodate that. All the gold is held on a fully allocated, insured basis. We have the list of the bars being held on our website. This latest fund that we're now going to launch later this month will be the silver-only fund, because we've had a lot of demand from our financial advisors. They like the original fund for strategic allocation, you know, in terms of a 10 to 20% allocation of a portfolio. But given silver is likely to outperform gold dramatically, they would like to add silver to increase the percentage allocation for some clients. That's what we're doing there. We also sell individual bars to high net worth investors, and we have storage facilities through Brinks all over the world. So the mutual funds are primarily designed for registered retirement accounts and smaller investors, and then the bullion bars are outside of registered accounts and meant for high net worth investors. So that way we try and cover the broad range.
We'll have links to Bullion Management Group available. You can just go to the website or click the emails that we send out to you on our list. We'd really like to invite you to return more regularly, if possible. Keep us updated in this exciting, nascent bull market.
I'd be happy to come back. Thank you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the 8th largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Well, returning to the show, the silver investor, David Morgan, our featured guest today. He pens the Morgan Report, which can be found at themorganreport.com. Welcome back, David Morgan.
Chris, great to be with you.
Start off our discussion today. Interesting story directly from a major silver mining CEO, one whom we've had on the show, has been a big supporter of GoldSeek for some time. This individual, after more than a decade of running a top not silver company, was approached by electronics maker First Majestic Silver Corp. This would be normal, I guess, if it was regular business, if it was a regular business practice. But the major Japanese electronics maker couldn't find, you know, enough silver stockpile, enough silver supply. This is the first time this has happened, as I mentioned, in about 13 years of business by Keith Neumeyer. That, of course, the CEO's name.
First of all, this is not the first time it's happened. There's an offtake agreement with Avino Silver, which is one of the companies that we had in the Morgan Report early on, and it's been a real stellar performer. And I own that stock. And also First Majestic I've owned for years. In fact, First Majestic was on our list at like $4 a share. We watched go all up to 24. We followed up with our stop losses outlining how to use the Morgan Report. And then it's come back and actually traded under that, which is hard to believe with all that's happened from, you know, way back when we first recommended the company. But regardless, I would say it's slightly different than you outlined it. First of all, I would say that this electronics firm is looking ahead to where there could be further tightness in supply, and they want a direct, you know, a direct source. But it's not indicative of a tight supply at the present time. So in other words, these are people with vision. These are people that realize that in the future there could be both demand on the silver supply, which means you have both industrial and investment demand. Basically, the industrial offtake is roughly 50% of the market. It's slightly more than that. It used to be about 35% of the market, and the market's growing. However, in all fairness, the industrial demand side of the equation has been flat, really, for quite a while now. Could it increase, as Keith outlined? I would say absolutely. Will it increase to, you know, some point where industrial demand is greater than the total mining and recycling supply? I'd say absolutely not. Price is a mitigator of anything that's wanted. So a lot of uneconomic silver projects right now at, sub $20 silver become very economic at $30 silver. So that means more supply is sitting there in the ground. So, you know, say, where is peak silver? We outlined that in the book, The Silver Manifesto, and went through our numbers and the reasons and the whys and the wherefores. And if you look at that and really study it, it's something that you could read once. And if you're really good, you might get it all. And, you know, personally speaking, it's something that if I were to see that book, didn't write it, I would have to read it a couple times to really let it all filter in. But the point, I think, is this. These companies that have vision realize that in the future that the silver supply will continue to tighten on both sides, the industrial demand side, and because of that fact, or at least in their belief, they're willing to negotiate something. But I just want to be, for the record, clear that actually took place a couple years prior with Avino Silver and Gold, and now, of course, First Majestic is an NYSE stock run by one of the top CEOs, as you well know, Keith Neumeyer, as you named. And also, because it's an NYSE stock, it carries a lot more clout than, let's say, Avino Silver might at this time. By the way, I do own First Majestic, if I didn't mention that.
That's a really interesting overview, and it's a little different from what we're hearing in the blogosphere today. Do you suspect other companies are being approached, similar offers made, or is this just an anomaly?
Well, actually, if you dig deep enough, what you'll find is those type of agreements are done and have been done for quite some time through a third party. So if you really look at what's called the book or what the over-the-counter agreements are, with the people that produce it, which are the miners, and the people that use it on an absolutely required basis, which are the industrial users, what you'll find is that there is an intermediary that actually has a direct line, let's say the smelter or the refiner, to take that silver and pipe it directly to the end user. So it's not a big shock. What is different is that the third party's been removed, and rather than go through a quote-unquote broker, they're doing it direct, which I think is smart on the part of the company, although it becomes more transparent. So it's obvious that, you know, the public wakes up and say, oh, this electronics firm, this conglomerate, this, you know, large corp is buying silver direct from a major producer like First Majestic. What does that mean? And what it means to me is that they're making sure that there is no third-party interference. Now, that's my opinion. And you know, Chris, I try to state the facts as much as I possibly can, but people pay us for our opinions, our, you know, ability to forecast the future, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I'm happy to see it. It does, to me, indicate what I've said since basically the beginning of the year. Silver and gold are trading differently than they have in a long time.
Almost 4 or 5 years of a downtrend, lower lows, lower highs, and now we finally see some excitement come back into the market. So certainly the underlying trend is starting to change. Do you suspect that this is a long-term theme, though? Could we just back and fill a number of years, as we saw the S&P 500 do, as we saw the HGX housing market following its crash? A lot of times, bear markets require 2 or 3 years to sort out.
Well, great question, and thanks for pointing that out. First of all, I will say I don't know. I mean, anyone that's really, you know, going to be honest is going to tell you that. Now, there'll be people that use, you know, computer software, and, you know, I have some. I have plenty of it, actually. But regardless, the market knows more than anybody. My take at this point is we've gotten a little bit overexcited with this first 4 months of the new year. We do have to back and fill into that space, which will probably take us through the summer doldrums. And I'm expecting a pretty strong finish to the end of the year, which is usually the seasonality of the gold and silver market. But it has not been for the last many years where we've gotten the lowest print of the year on the last trading day of the year. So I'm well aware of that, and I'll just watch the market closely to make sure that, you know, it's going to tell me which way it's going to go. And that's how I operate, and that's what I do for the premium subscribers, is I show them exactly how the market should be interpreted based on the methodology that I've used. So coming back on point, my work shows we can't go that far. Why not? Well, because there's too much pressure on the investment demand side because of what's going on in the global empire. The empire is breaking down. Major parties are admitting that, and even using the word collapse, you've got the bond king, Bill Gross. You've got Abe saying that, you know, things are looking shaky. Maybe there's going to be, you know, global problems, I'll put it softly. And so more and more are pretty much sticking their neck out because they don't want to be in a position politically where they say, well, you never said it, or you said the opposite. You know, they don't want to say something to the effect that, you know, this conspiracy theory doesn't mean anything, and that type of thing. Well-known political figure, you know, you're peddling fiction by saying the economy isn't strong, wonderful, everything's great, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm very happy to see the position that we're in. We got a nice, strong start. We got good volume. Now we're back in fill. And I think, again, that we're going to probably be up and away. Not majorly. As you well know, Chris, you do technical work as well. Unless, you know, there's a huge black swan, which is obviously out there. There's so many of them, in fact. Nonetheless, without that type of an event, it will have to work through certain levels, but it will do that on the way up pretty rapidly, and then we'll get into that parabolic move that we already witnessed in 2011 in the first quarter. And we'll see it again, except this time it's going to make that move look like a, you know, warm up.
You know, I think it's a great point. And if we take a look at just the XAU, which from, you know, the nadir of the trough there to its recent peak or zenith, we saw at least a 100% move. Still holding on to the better portion of that advance. But, you know, the underlying bullion, gold and silver, has not performed, although it's been spectacular. We haven't seen that 100% move yet. It's obviously not as leveraged as the shares. I guess what I'm getting at is for the naysayers out there who don't think the metals, you know, silver can run back to 30, that would represent approximately, you know, 100% advance from the lows or close to it.
Well, absolutely. It's one of the prime indicators that I look at. It has to be on volume. In other words, it can't be like it's got to be where the big money's coming in, and it is. And that's confirmation that we're back to the bull market. Sure, we may touch or kiss the launch point, which is what I expect. And we could go lower. We could test the old lows, whatever it was. I forget the exact numbers. Like, I know we traded a touch under 14 on silver, and I think we touched 1059 or something in that range on gold. We could hit those levels again. I really, really doubt it. But the stocks are telling us and screaming at us and, you know, ringing the bell at the bottom that the bottom is in. So the way to really make money in this market is to buy your physical bullion position and then get into the paper. And I know that I'm anti-paper and I don't want to confuse anybody, but what I just said, I'll repeat. Once you have established a physical, you can touch it position, the way to beat the bankers, the way to make a lot of fiat and then turn it into physical is to go into the paper markets. And there's no better way than to outline what we do, which is top tier, mid tier, and speculative companies, well diversified, and watch these things go from 35 cents to 12 bucks, like I did on a Molly company, for an example. Look at Silver Standard. We had a 65 cents Canadian. I think that went to $40. We got out at 21. Hecla Mining, we got in at 50 cents. It got out at $5. A TED bag or an NYSE stock. We did a good on Hecla Mining before anybody even knew our name or what the Morgan Report was about. And that was the same exact performance, a 10-bagger on an NYSE stock when it was the top-performing stock in the entire stock exchange in 1979. Everybody knew Hecla Mining in 1979 because of the Hunt brothers and what silver did in that 1 year, going from $6 to $50. I think we're going to see that again, Chris. In fact, I think we're going to see something even better than that just next time because it's a global empire that's being destroyed, which means all currencies will be seeking gold and silver. Once that happens, there's really no limit. Now, I'm being a bit, I don't want to be hypey, but I'm being accurate in a way because in the reality of the situation, there is a denominator of zero. There is no upside in a paper price. That's in theory. Do all paper currencies fail to absolute zero? No, they do not. There will be an intervention. There will be a reset. There'll be a new Bretton Woods. There'll be the SDR that proposed. I mean, there'll be a lot of things that will be on the table that could take place. All no cash, all electronic form. I mean, there's a lot out there that we all know about. We're all looking toward, and everyone's asking the same question, what is the next step going to look like? And the answer is really, I don't know, and very few know, and even the powers that be may not know exactly because there's infighting at the top of the pyramid.
Still a lot of negativity by those outside of the precious metals crowd. The advance this year, I mean, the hottest commodities around, although we all know they're much more than just commodities. That's the way they view this. They view them as hyperactive commodities that were oversold, and there's been some short covering, maybe a short squeeze, if you will, at the bottom. Here's the problem, I think, with their thesis. Take a look at the last time we had a peak, right, in around 1979, 1980. The underlying economics supported a peak. I mean, we had runaway inflation that was then capped with incredibly high real interest rates, which was fomented by the Federal Reserve. Right now, we have just the opposite. You remember Barsky and Summers' seminal paper, where they outline one of the most important essential ingredients for a gold and silver rally? Is negative real rates of return. Fed maybe will get one more quarter point rate hike this year. It's looking maybe July of this year. Give us your thoughts on the economics behind a potential explosive rally in the precious metals, please.
Well, I mean, I've been saying for quite some time, and especially in the, you know, lectures that I do throughout various areas, you know, Sweden, I just came back from, and you know, Canada, wherever I'm asked. But regardless, the biggest leg up is yet to take place. I believe it's in our future. I believe the time frame is probably 2017-18 in that range. I don't think it's 5 years out. I think it's more like 3 years out. I think it'll go into the financial record books, and it's going to be based on fear more than greed. It'll be because there's the perception, and perception is reality in most cases, which means that the public will come into the market to preserve whatever capital they have, and they'll come into the gold market in a very big way. But when gold gets to the point of affordability for the average person that has some savings, they'll move into the silver market. And since the silver market is a much smaller market than the gold market, you'll see something similar to what we saw in the 1980 peak we referred to. gold from January to January basically went from like the 300 to the 850 level, or silver went again from 6 to 50. So you had like a triple versus an eight bagger. And this is what I expect to happen again, except this time the numbers could be even larger and I could be, you know, off. I mean, I never said I had an absolute perfect crystal ball, but I'm, you know, studied monetary history for a very long time. And we've looked at what these banks are doing to resolve the problem. And the main problem about the problem is that the problem is not even addressed. And I know I said problem three words. I used alliteration to make this point. Until you can, one, address the problem, you're not going to solve it. And it's a debt problem. And they're trying to solve it with more debt. I mean, how preposterous is that? And these are the so-called leaders. These are people that are actually exempt from leadership roles, as Alan Greenspan so eloquently pointed out, that basically the Federal Reserve is a private corp owned mostly by Europeans, I added that doesn't have to answer to anybody. And, of course, there is a very big tie to the federal government. I don't want to discount that too much, but in theory, they don't have to answer anybody and have done things that have been, let's say, surprises to the market from time to time. But they are not all-powerful, although many people think they are. They are not. The market's more powerful than even the Fed. So what I'm saying is that look out for what's happening ahead. It's going to be more volatile. And people, as the trust breaks down, as the confidence breaks down, people go to where they trust and have the most confidence. And that is absolutely 100% physical paper. People will go to cash. And now if cash is outlawed, that will speed the movement into the top of the pyramid, which is the precious metal. So I see a big run to cash. I see a big run to the U.S. dollar, and that's going to get a lot of gold bugs upset. Why isn't gold going up? But it's a step in the process of the breakdown crisis. So step in the process is you're going to see a run to cash. You're going to see a run to dollar. You're going to see the dollar being like the king again. And then you're going to say, where do we go now? And when that psychology takes place and that takes hold, there's nothing that can undo it. There's no fever like gold fever. And once that psychology breaks, look out. The run to gold will be unprecedented.
And I think the key here will be, you know, a lot of people are turning to Bitcoin and alternatives like that, thinking that it will be a safe haven. I think they might be missing out on some of the limitations there to transport. Of course, you have the electronic convenience there of Bitcoin. But at the same time, I think there's always going to be some big question marks on who owns what. I mean, for instance, we had a Bitcoin major dealer and marketplace sued to the tunes of hundreds of millions of dollars because they, you know, had a minor glitch and lost an enormous amount, something like $250 million worth of Bitcoins just evaporated in midair. Well, gold has a tendency not to evaporate, and so does silver. Isn't it interesting that we read story after story on the mainline media that cash is being decimated around the world? I mean, we see government after government policymakers doing everything they can globally to eliminate reliance on basic hard currency. The whole push is towards debit cards, electronic transactions. Big Brother wants to have its fingers in the pie. It wants to know every single tax dollar you can extract much more readily. You might hear all kinds of arguments saying, well, it discourages money laundering and illegal transactions, but in reality, it limits freedom. And maybe that's a topic for another discussion. What I was really driving towards here was your point of this mad dash to cash, let's call it. I suspect that most people will be disappointed by hard cash, and I think you do as well. Let's start off with Bitcoin and electronic alternatives. How much of a threat is this to bullion?
Well, that's a great question. The answer, I really don't know. If you want my take on it, you can Google David Morgan, My Two Bits About Bitcoin, I think was the title of the article. I'm free market, and, you know, I can't be a hypocrite, although I'm sure there's those that may think so, but I do my best to be consistent. And so if the free market says Bitcoin's the way to go, who am I? I'm just some guy here that's, you know, an advocate of honesty and, you know, a lot of things, but honest money, you know, correctness in the political system, should be in the financial system. Of course, it'd be nice in the political system as well. Regardless, I'm not a big fan of Bitcoin, but I'm not against it either. I think it's an alternative, and I think a lot of the gold-silver community have moved into it. I have no problem with that. What my concerns are is the same as yours. I think unless you have the best base of your foundational savings program, which is physical gold and silver, then going into Bitcoin, I think would be fine. If you were electronic dependent only, think about it for a minute. It goes back to what you said about Big Brother. You are an electronic format. That means you have to be tied to the internet. It also means, depending on who you want to look at, but you can use the NSA as an example, you know, how secure is it really as far as the prying eyes are concerned? The last thing is basically the research I've done, it was done, and I'll give a shout out to Charles Savoy, who's not very well known, sent me his research, and he's one of the best, and I'm so proud to say that he contacted me so very early on when I started the website. The CIA was basically the first ones to put out a white paper looking for an all-electronic alternative, I'll call it, quote-unquote, banking system. That wasn't the words used in their paper. So you have to, you know, look really deep and down the rabbit hole, and I'm not saying anything that I know for a fact, but you could make an argument that the beginning of the electronic alternative currencies outside the banking system may have been something that was forecast or anticipated by the powers that be. And I'm not saying I can prove that, but it is interesting that I can show you, and I'm not going to put it in the public domain, it'd be something private, what was out there in this white paper. So who knows? You know, again, I'm free market. If you want to go Bitcoin or an alternative to Bitcoin, I'm all for it. And let me go a step further. A lot of the push of the Morgan Report going forward is for financial technology, fintech, as it's referred to. And I'm looking very strongly at alternatives outside the banking system. Bitcoin is one of them. I'm not trying to be a hypocrite here. I think there are alternatives that will manifest that will be bullion backed. So there'll be a physical backing in the electronic form that you could get, let's say, a real Bitcoin, meaning, you know, I know they make them, but what I'm saying is, you know, an equivalent gold or silver position type of thing. So it's a developing technology. It's very interesting. I'm doing my homework on it. I've just ordered 2 books from Amazon. I have a friend that's very connected there and others in the industry, which you probably know by first name. And so I'm looking at that because I think that any time there is extreme amount of pressure, there will be a relief valve somewhere. And the relief valve is that the free market, sometimes called the black market, will be an alternative. And that's what we're seeing, especially the millennials. I mean, how many millennials do they even have bank accounts? So there's the system is ripe for an alternative. I think the only power structure that really gets that is London, which is basically the base of the Anglo-American Empire. If you study it closely enough, and I'll be writing about more of this in the future, is they're actually embracing financial technology. Why? Because they want to continue to control. And if you're moving out of the traditional banking system that you and I, Chris, have known our whole lives, and you move into this, like I'm on my phone, and I do a peer-to-peer payment, and it's outside of the banking system, they don't want that outside of their control. They want to be in on it. So very interesting times ahead, rapid change. There's what I would call maybe the revolution, you know, meaning there could be a monetary revolution. In fact, I would suggest that maybe too strong a word, but maybe not. I want people to think that there are all these alternatives out there and they're popping up here, there, and everywhere. There'll be winners and losers, but I like the idea that people are saying, you know what? We can create our own system of settlement. We can do it without the banks. We don't need you. And this, of course, is taking place, but on a very low level. But all things start at the beginning, don't they?
You're looking at it from the right angle. You know, supply creates its own demand. Options for the everyday financial transaction could drive a Bitcoin-like alternative, and that's what Bitcoin seems to be doing. It's not putting cash out of business. It's not putting banking out of business. It's just creating its marketplace of its own. NSA, as we all know, thanks to Snowden, has its finger in every transaction online and every conversation online, and you can be sure if they don't, someone above them does. The encryption, I think, is a bit outdated, even though I know everyone thinks it's uncrackable. The NSA and the U.S. government are 20 to 30 years ahead of us with encryption. Factoring prime numbers is no problem for them. I know this is going to be hard for some of our listeners to believe, but factoring enormously large prime numbers, which is what our entire financial security system is based on, is really just a simple process. So if they really want to crack into an account, they can do it. But, you know, again, that's another topic. Let's move back to precious metals. I wanted to ask you about financial instruments such as shares in, let's say, the S&P 500, in Google. Let's take Google, for example, Netflix, Amazon, Tesla. You can buy these shares no matter what the price is. There's always going to be a market. I'd like for our listeners to be reintroduced to the concept that gold and silver, there's a limited supply. There may be a market. There may be a paper market. But once confidence is lost in the ETFs and their ability to perform the contracts, the only thing left are the metals. Maybe silver is suddenly at $100 an ounce, but there's always going to be that proviso if you can find it.
There is a limited amount. There's, you know, the paper paradigm in the gold and silver industry is, you know, roughly 100 to 1. You can make it even 10 to 1. And it goes back to the goldsmiths. I mean, they realized when they were giving out warehouse receipts that about only 10% ever came back and actually exchanged gold. So they started floating worthless paper, but no one knew it because the system worked with a float of 9 to 1 or 10 to 1 roughly. So the whole banking system is based on that premise of fractional reserve. Well, you have fractional reserve banking in the bullion side, and which means that everyone's happy as long as no one really steps up to the window and says, give me gold for this certificate. I own X amount of gold in the XYZ corporation. And because of that, things are just happy to go along the way they are. It also provides a fictional supply because all markets move on supply and demand. So if you can increase the supply by a factor of 10, then what do you think it's going to do to the supply-demand curve? Well, it's going to move it down because there's all this fictional supply out there. So that's a good way to manage the market. When the confidence level, as you said, I'm just repeating back to you really, gets to the critical juncture we talked about earlier in your show, that people say, you know, I don't really trust this anymore. I've got this pretty looking certificate that says I own X amount of gold. I'm taking it over to my bank or over to my broker and I'm going to cash it in. And they say, get in line. We've had a run on the bank. Those are my words, not theirs. They'll use some, you know, obfuscation of, you know, well, there's been a delay and we've been ordered by the Fed to only allocate what's remaining due to the fact that there's a blah, 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 blah. Make it up. They'll make it up. So it's better to be safe than sorry. And, you know, I'm nothing against the ETFs or, you know, any of these paper markets, as long as you start with a foundational amount that's safe. In other words, let's just take a real rough example. Let's say you're gray-haired like me and so where would you be? I'd say in that case, you know, and it's individual, you know, maybe you're at 30% physical, 40% physical. So, you know, let's say that all my top tier, mid tier and speculative stocks and the precious metals go to zero. I would be extremely unhappy, but I'd have such a strong physical position and the paper price of it or the value of it would go up so much that I'd be more than well protected. On the other hand, again, the way to beat the bankers is if there's a physical lockup in the metals, which I expect there will be, then these shares will go into the stratosphere. You won't be able to put a price on them because that's be the only thing that's remaining. And although they're a piece of paper, if they're the real companies, such as First Majestic, as we talked about, or Avino, for example, these things will have a price that will go crazy because it's the only thing left. And there's a small, small market. People don't realize the word precious and what it really, really means. I mean, if you look at 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools full of gold, then that's the entire Earth supply over 5,000 years. And you go out on the moon with your big telescope and you look down on the planet and you compare 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools to how many Olympic-sized swimming pools exist on the planet, or better yet, how many gas stations exist on the planet. Get a perspective on the commodity oil versus the quote-unquote commodity slash it's now money, gold, and how little gold there is compared to how much oil there is or how much wheat there is or any other commodity. So we're in a predicament, and there's no way out, and the bankers know it. And, of course, they're trying to stay ahead of the game, and perhaps they are. But from my perspective, just because they have it planned out, we're going to this and that, we're going to let this one collapse, we're slowly going to let the yen go up against the dollar, we're going to let China go down again, you know, whatever. I mean, whatever machinations they've come up with to control the situation, the more they try to control it, I would say the more it's going to be out of control. And the problem with most, well, the more you try to control it, I mean, you're balancing an upside-down pyramid is what you're doing. I mean, a pyramid is the most stable structure known to man, and the financial system is built on an upside-down pyramid, which implies logically it's the most unstable situation you could possibly have. And unless you continue to grow the base, the pyramid's going to topple over, which, you know, it doesn't make sense from what I just said. But the point is that the derivatives market is what's ruling everything. So it's a Ponzi scheme on top of Ponzi scheme on top of bet on top of side bet on top of bet on bet on top of that. And it's all precarious as can be. It's the fall, collapse of complex societies. It's the collapse of a complex financial system that nobody understands. And everybody's betting their bottom dollar on the fact that the computers and the electronic world is so powerful that everything's under control.
You talk about three Olympic-sized pools full of gold bullion, and that's essentially the accessible reserves or supply of gold, at least above ground now, circulating in the world and from antiquity until today. Hold on to that image and keep in mind that there's roughly the same amount of gold as there was 30 years ago at the last peak. But now the population of the world has grown by at least double. The amount of wealth, let's just say, has increased. Add in derivatives. Ease of access through eBay and other alternatives, a confluence of events.
Fortunately, it's a reality, and these events happen rarely. This is not something that takes place every year in the financial markets. I don't want to overplay the Shemitah thing, but I've read the book and listened to a couple of Jonathan Kahn's interviews, and I know Jeff Berwick, and I was actually well aware of it probably prior to Berwick, not that it matters, but the point being is that like a jubilee, which is 7/7 or every 50 years, this is something that's possibly a once-in-a-lifetime event. Certainly it's taken place before. I mean, if you look at monetary history, you know, it's the Weimar Republic's one that's most commonly referred to. But if you look at the book, The Silver Manifesto, and you open up to the part of currency failures, you'll see the currency failures between like 1981 and 1990, and I don't know, there are 40 countries. And then the failure between 1991 and 2000, I think it's like 50 or 60 countries. But this is all brushed under the carpet because there's the ability of these countries that have a failed currency like Zimbabwe to use the U.S. dollar. And that's dollars in physical form, what we talked about earlier. So going forward, we do have a synergy of events. We have a distrust in the political system. We have a distrust in the food system with GMOs. We have a distrust in the water supply with fluoridation and what's going on with the, you know, chemical bases. We have a distrust of what's going on in the atmosphere. So basically, we have corruption across the board. We have physical corruption. We've got the Fukushima. We've got the BP oil spill. So we have a confluence of synergistic events that are compounding one on top of the other. So in a mathematical formula type of thing, going back to the Bitcoin, I just watched The Man Who Saw Infinity, and I got a pretty strong math background. But yes, it can do what you said. So coming back on point, we're going to see a synergistic effect where 1 plus 1 plus 1 doesn't equal 3, 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 30. That's an exponential function. So when the panic starts, and when that, you know, third person walks up to the bullion bank and says, here's a cert I've had for 10 years. I've got this much gold. I want the gold physically. And they say, oh, no, you don't. He says, oh, yes, I do. I'm standing for delivery. That is when no one can predict exactly when. And that's just an analogy or a metaphor to the what's going to cause it. But what's going to cause it is a shift in psychology. I don't trust even these physical dollars anymore. I can't get them or I don't want them. I rather have the real deal. And there's so little relative to the amount of fiat available in all currencies. And that's why you'll see gold go up against all currencies. Yeah, it's the anti-U.S. dollar for now, because the dollar will be the last man standing. I have little doubt about that. And the alternatives that the BRICS have put in are certainly some protection. But whether or not it's robust enough, if it's anti-fragile enough or not, at this point, I doubt it. But that's my take. That's my opinion. It can't be proven. Only the market will prove true or false on that. So we're in a situation again, that I want to emphasize where it's very rare that this will take place, but I have little doubt it will happen in my lifetime.
I just wanted to mention, you brought up the man who saw Infinity or knew Infinity, and of course that's the story of Srinivasa Ramanujan. I have the book here on my desktop. It's free now for anyone who's interested in listening to our voices. I'll send you a copy, and it's just must read. In fact, I would argue that the author has composed one of the finest books, not just on mathematics or any subject. You can't put it down. Even folks who don't care for reading, you won't be able to put this tome down. I have a link to the free story about how G.W. Hardy, one of the world's greatest mathematicians in Oxford at the time, and identified Ramanujan just in the remote nowhere, essentially self-taught. He found a remarkable book by a man who became renowned later, but he just didn't require any proofs at all, what we call today shortcuts in his mathematical endeavors. And this remarkable book is still available. I have a copy I'd like to give to my son, and when he's a few years older. And I think it's just a fantastic story. But, the movie, huge fan of Jeremy Irons. What you want is the book here. And I'll bet you've read that. If you don't have a copy, I'll fire one over to you. I'd like to discuss one more topic, and that is the idea that silver has an enormous amount of uses, and it is rarely reclaimed after it's used. Here's an example. Solar power. They have dropped in price. And I remember when solar panels were only for the very wealthy, even the elite. Well, now a family can have a small solar array for just a few $1,000s or less. Each solar panel has roughly 1 ounce, requires a roughly 1 ounce of silver to produce. That a hyperbolic decline in the price of solar panels and the extreme affordability of silver is creating its own demand. Do you want to just run with the ball and give us an idea of whether or not this solar power revolution could bode well for silver investors?
Well, a couple points. First, the recycling industry is actually pretty robust. There is a lot of silver that makes it to the landfill and never gets recycled. Having said that, if you look at the two silver studies, and of course I buy them and study them every year and have since, I don't know what, when I was much younger. The amount of silver recycled is like 170 million ounces a year. So that's a significant amount, especially when you compare it to the amount of silver that was mined on an annual basis up to about 1985, never rose above 350 million ounces. After that, there was a change in the technology to how to mine, and that was a big push into bringing more silver above ground than ever before. Coming back on point, so there is a fair amount of recycling. On the solar situation, I wrote Silver Over the Next Decade, and in that study, one of the main points I looked at was the solar industry. And at the time, it had not an exponential curve, but a very strong linear curve at about a 45-degree angle, and it was projecting solar to use about 140 million ounces of silver on an annual basis relative to about 2016. Remember, this study was done in 2010, so it's projecting out about 6-7 years. That projection was actually accurate for about three or four years. Since then, it's leveled off and actually butt back down. What's interesting, if you did it on a solar panel basis, it would fit that curve almost exactly. The problem is it doesn't fit the curve in the solar usage, the silver usage in solar went down is because, like anything economic, you squeeze the margins. If you can get X amount of power by using half the amount of silver, you're going to do it. And that's what's taken place. In other words, solar panels have become much more efficient. Silver's not the only component. There's other silicon, and a lot of stuff that goes into one. And the manufacturing process, taking it over to China primarily. So there are a lot of reasons that on a per-panel basis, not only squeeze the amount of silver per panel and increase the efficiency, meaning you still get as much power as per panel as you used to, it hasn't distorted the curve. It is what it is. The market's the market. So where are we now? Well, I'm still bullish on the solar, meaning that India looks like they're going to produce a lot of electricity using solar. So I think you'll see a swing up in the curve. And also, as you said, the demand situation. Yes, I do have some solar here. It's just basically back up as a put up kind of a thing. In other words, some panels that I can just throw up, and I've used it, in fact, and charge a set of gigantic batteries and run my electronics from that. But back on point, so yeah, the more affordable it is, especially in some locations. Now, solar is efficient as, you know, burning coal. No, it's not. But it's certainly a lot of people want independence. And in certain areas, I mean, solar is the only thing you can have. I mean, you can take a mountain cabin out in the middle of nowhere. You're not going to have a power line over there. So I am, you know, neutral as far as efficiency, looking at it from an engineering perspective, but looking at it from an economic perspective, I think we have seen a dip, and I don't think we'll see an upswing in the solar demand, but I don't think it will be as robust as Jessica Cross indicated when she put out her report in 2010, which is what I referred to in mine, citing her work in that area. Of course, I added my own thoughts, but nonetheless, an important and significant part, which leads us all the way back to the beginning of the interview, which means, you know, why are these electronic companies going to major silver producers and saying, give me direct, I don't want a middleman? And the reason is that it's not just solar, it's electronic gadgets. As I've said in the past, you know, silver is the best technology stock you can buy. Hey, it's a physical element. So there's a lot going on across the board. And one that we never talk about is what is the military use of the silver supply? And no one really knows the exact amount, but a lot of mil-spec electronics are driven by silver. You think that their solar panels aren't the top-notch solar panels? What do you think about their battery life? You think they're using lithium everywhere? Yeah, they use a lot of lithium. But when it hits a mil-spec and it's got to be out there for days and days, guess what? They're using silver-based batteries. So there's a lot that goes on that really isn't known. I mean, there are some enigmas in the silver market. I certainly never claim to know it all. Certainly, I continue to research and learn more. But there's no one on the planet that has every detail about any commodity, let alone the silver market.
I have a slightly different view on the exponential growth of solar panels, and there's a couple of reasons why. Firstly, gold and silver, the best conductors. Of course, gold, slightly better electronic conductor, but silver, of course, is much more cost-effective at, let's say, 70 times less per ounce. It's viewed as insignificant in the process right now. That's going to change, I'm sure you'd agree. There is, from what I've read, absolutely no alternative. Copper cannot take the place of silver in extremely sensitive electronics, and that's what we really have today, advanced electronics. And I'd also add that we're looking for, according to several recent studies, exponential growth in the demand for solar power. There are some indications that the entire coal business around the world, even in China, and of course the United States is a Saudi Arabia, as you know, of coal, a complete shutdown of all coal production. Firstly, because of environmental reasons. Secondly, because of the rise, the exponential increase in affordability of solar power. So the combination, another confluence of events, could send silver almost to parity with gold.
Well, I think it'll be a good year, not a great year. I want to offer everybody a free report. It's on themorganreport.com. All we need is a first name and an email address. And it's a 12-page report that I wrote myself. You'll get access to a movie about the Age of Empire and the collapse and where we are, with some solutions at the end of the movie, which are definitely worth considering. A lot of other information. If you go to if you use Twitter at all, look for hashtag Silver Affiliate. I've got some information there. So you, if you're a silver or a gold stacker, you can actually get paid while you stack. And then the video, the Twitter feed is at SilverGuru22, and the YouTube channel is SilverGuru.
We appreciate your comments here on the markets and look forward to more of those in 2016.
My pleasure. Thank you, Chris.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity. Brazil Resources, based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves. Industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember, to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond, your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Last week, one of the U.S.'s largest banks, Wells Fargo, reached a $185 million settlement regarding 5,300 of its employees who opened roughly 1.5 million bank accounts and nearly 565,000 credit card accounts between 2011 and 2015 that may not have been authorized by the bank's customers. According to reports of the settlement, employees issued debit cards with fake PINs and used phony email addresses to secretly sign up customers for online banking. They temporarily transferred customers' money to the bogus bank accounts, at times leaving a low balance and triggering overdraft or other charges, according to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. Many customers also were charged annual fees and interest on the credit cards. The bank did not admit any wrongdoing as part of the settlement. However, the bank must refund all customers' wrongly charged fees and pay penalties totaling $185 million to the CFPB, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and to Los Angeles city and county officials. The CFPB will receive $100 million, which is the largest fine imposed by the agency in its five-year history. According to a USA Today article, bank customers already have received a total of $2.6 million in refunds, with the average payment being just $25. From a quick back-of-the-napkin calculation, that doesn't seem like very much. When you realize the typical overdraft is usually more in the neighborhood of $35, something still doesn't seem to add up, at least for the consumer. Catherine Austin Fitz, former Assistant Secretary of Housing under the Bush 1 administration, raised some interesting questions on her website, Solari.com. With all of that open additional credit, she said if she were questioning the participants in her former role, she would ask, in part, how many credit cards were issued to the phony account holders? How many auto loans were originated for the phony holders? How many mortgage loans were originated for the phony holders? If any mortgages were issued, were they insured, securitized, and then purchased by central banks? If they were, are any of them included on the Fed's balance sheet? It's worth a visit to her website to see all the questions, but you get the idea. Just like in many accident cases and class action lawsuits, the consumer or plaintiff is merely the vehicle for large enterprises to negotiate settlements from one organization to another in the name of consumer justice. Because in the end, the actual consumer suffers all the frustrations, the lower credit scores, the long waits on hold to repair account abnormalities, the missed payments because of lack of funds in their accounts, and all the other stuff the average person just deals with every day. No consumer will really benefit from this settlement. It simply represents the illusion of change. Chris, I'd like to direct our listeners to visit my website at conquerchange.com and join my new email list. I've been gearing up for some time now to release new content and special features, which are soon to be around the corner. So please direct your browser to conquerchange.com and sign up today. Updates will follow soon. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with conquerchange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week. The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank. And founding director, their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. We'll be right back.